This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We have been pumping and taking out so much water from aquifers, so much groundwater, that we are reaching basically a point of no return where we won't have enough fresh water to keep the amazing city of Los Angeles green forever, or we won't be able to keep Las Vegas the oasis that it is.
In the film adaptation of The Lorax by Dr. Seuss, the unscrupulous Aloysius O'Hare sells oxygen. The audience is shocked and dismayed by this wanton commodification of a fundamental natural resource. But the commodification of another life-sustaining resource is no fiction in the American West. This week on Sea Change Radio, we get a bit of a history lesson about water rights in the West from Varsha Venkata Subramanian, a graduate student and a contributor to the editorial board. We learn about the beginnings of Los Angeles and the critical role that water played in that city's birth, why water rights differ east and west of the Mississippi, and how climate change is making water scarcer and scarcer for millions of Westerners. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Varsha Venkata Subramanian. She is a graduate student at UC Berkeley and the newest contributor to the editorial board. Varsha, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Alex.
So you wrote a piece for the editorial board, which is also available on Alternet, entitled "The Water Wars Are Coming to a State Near You." In fact, they're already here. You study policy and the history of policy. Why don't you take us back to the turn of the century in Los Angeles, and then we can go through some of the more important policy decisions in terms of water and then how that's going to affect moving forward as these regions in the West continue to desertify, if you will.
Yeah, definitely. So imagine yourself in early 20th century California. Basically, there are not a lot of settlers, not a lot of white citizens in California yet. They have been moving into California for most of the 19th century, but Los Angeles, Sacramento, San Francisco are not the big, big cities that they are today. That transformation takes place in the early 20th century. One thing to know about the American West is that water, since the California Gold Rush and even before that, water in the American West has consistently been like the sacred commodity, right? It has been sacred, and it has always been pretty scarce, especially in the American West because of its arid climate. In the early 20th century, when the populations of cities, especially like Los Angeles, are starting to grow, right? And they're starting to grow to, 100,000 and then eventually 200,000, these cities start needing more and more water. But the thing about the West is that water rights are allocated differently in American history in the American West than they were in the American East, right? In the American East, you sort of have this thing called riparian rights, where basically if you live next to the river, you have access to the water, right? Or if you have used the water and you live near the river, then you have a right to the river. But in California, in the far West, mainly anywhere west of the Mississippi, there is this process, there is this precedent of whoever is first there, they're the ones who get the water. It's basically similar to the miners' code when there was a lot of gold mining and mineral mining taking place in the American West. So it's this doctrine of like prior appropriation. So the issue is, by the time you get to the early 20th century in like 1904, 1905, most citizens of the American West, but especially Angelenos, they need water. They really, really need water because the city is growing faster and faster and faster. So they need water not just for irrigation and agriculture, but also just for their citizens. And so one of the major characters in the story is William Mulholland, who is like an Irish immigrant. He arrives in America with like basically nothing to his name. And then like 10 years later, he's like the superintendent to the city of Los Angeles, and he's helping dealing with the water supply. And he comes up with this plan of basically diverting a lot more water from the Owens Valley, which is next door to to Los Angeles into Los Angeles, taking the water from the Owens Valley into Los Angeles. Obviously, this pisses off people in the Owens Valley. And initially, there's like, you know, this fight over water, this fight over building a dam or building a canal or taking this water from the Owens Valley into Los Angeles is like a legal fight. You know, it's in the legislature. Los Angeles and Mulholland end up getting support from the federal government. And obviously, the citizens of Owens Valley, they decide to sue almost immediately. But what's interesting and why you know, historians have called it a water war, and it's one of California's first water wars, is because the citizens of Owens Valley realize maybe the court is not going to come up on our side. And they don't. And so they literally decide, okay, we're just going to turn to violence. And they take some dynamite and they just show up to blow up the ditch that has been built. And so there is a lot of violence. There's violence between these two cities, between the citizens of these two cities, up until finally, you know, it's quelled. So that's where the story sort of begins. And a lot of great historians have sort of written about this. But what I find really interesting about it is that people like Mulholland, people who are living in Los Angeles, they were just so narrowly focused on doing whatever it took to get as much water as possible for the citizens of Los Angeles. And it is that type of like single-minded like dedication that characterizes the history of like getting water in the American West, especially in the 20th century.
Yes, I mean, we could go back even another decade or two, or even three or four decades, when a lot of the dams that were constructed in the American West were used as you write, a way to attract settlers, agricultural settlers in particular.
Yeah, and so basically what's going on since the 1850s, the federal government is doing its best to get settlers into the American West, and settlers are getting more and more interested in this. But where water comes in is not just in this, you know, dispute over water rights between different groups of white settlers, but another thing I write about in the article and what's really characterizes the story of Western water is Native Americans already live here. Right. And so by the time a lot more Western settlers have settled in the late 19th century, more and more Native Americans have been pushed further and further onto reservations. And this is basically the case for most Native Americans by the time you get to the 1900s, right? Or the early 1900s. But the problem is, even if Native Americans are on reservations, even if, you know, white people or federal employees are leading these reservations, Native Americans still need water for their reservations to survive. And so one of the most important cases that sort of highlights this conflict between white settlers and Native Americans is Winters v. United States in 1908. And so one would think, okay, it's a Supreme Court case. The Supreme Court has a history of being, let's say, problematic. Obviously, the case is not going to end up good for Native Americans. But ironically, it does. So basically what the white district attorney or the white U.S. attorney who shows up in Montana to argue for this reservation, what he argues in front of the local judge and then the Ninth Circuit and then finally the Supreme Court is these Native Americans at this reservation, they signed a treaty with the federal government. And that federal government promised them, you know, enough water and food or whatever in order to survive on this reservation. Therefore, the federal government has a duty to provide enough water for Native Americans, which means this river, the Milk River that they're fighting between Winters and his settlers, these white settlers, and the local reservation, there is a certain amount of that water is reserved for Native Americans. They have the reserved rights, and that's where this reserved rights doctrine comes in, and it totally upends this prior appropriation doctrine, right? And so initially you would think, oh yeah, this is great for Native Americans. They're going to be able to get the water they need. But the problem is you can't just say, okay, now you have water rights. That's like great on paper. But the actual wet water rights, that's something that Native Americans are still fighting for.
Now explain what that means. What are wet water rights?
Yeah, so basically what I mean by that is paper water rights is that on paper it says X reservation has X access to, you know, has this much access to this much water from this river. That's what it says on paper. That is what the Supreme Court will say. That is what, you know, a state government will support. But in order to actually make use of that water and turn that paper right into an actual wet right, you need to invest money. And by money, I mean you need to invest infrastructure, either spending money from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Bureau of Reclamation to develop irrigation and safe extraction of water for Native Americans on their lands, or is it building dams or a bunch of different types of infrastructure, right? But the problem is, over the course of the 20th century, that type of funding has been not highly allocated to Native American reservations, let's just say. There are cases, there are many cases where, you know, the Bureau of Indian Affairs is actually able to get money in, but Native Americans aren't really able to make use of their water rights to the fullest extent. And that, you know, that problem is only exacerbated when you get to later cases in Supreme Court history, especially Arizona versus California. So one of these cases, there's a bunch of Arizona versus California, but one of these cases basically says, the Supreme Court says, okay, we've been talking about not just Native American water rights, but specifically water, that's water rights for the federal government compared to state governments, compared to private entities. And what this case, as well as, you know, years of precedent basically says, Supreme Court says, now if there is water on federal land, is reserved for the federal government. And so basically there's this big conflict between which water is the federal government's water and which water belongs to the state. But in the middle of this dispute, initially you would think, okay, Native Americans are on federal land, therefore that means Native Americans get the water. But that's not what ends up happening. It just makes it easier and easier for the federal government to invest in water projects that they want, or state governments to invest in water projects that they want from the water that's not on federal land, and Native Americans are basically left behind. So that's what I mean by the lack of wet water rights. There are actually Native Americans in various tribes, either if they're in California, in the Colorado River, in Washington, in Arizona, they're not fully able to access the water that they have a legal right to. And this is why when it comes to drought and when it comes to water scarcity and water poverty, Native Americans are top on the list of people who don't have access to water in America, even just clean drinking water.
Wade in the water, come on and wade in the water, children, wade in the water. My Lord, my God, gonna trouble the water.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Varsha Venkata Subramanian. She is a graduate student at UC Berkeley and the newest contributor to the editorial board. So Varsha, there's a big difference, as you explained, between wet water rights and legal rights to water. And we see this if you visit a indigenous tribe. It may be in some of the more arid parts of the country, but then you drive through Central Valley of California, and it's also a very arid place, and yet it's become the breadbasket of much of America. Why don't you kind of connect the dots then with what Mulholland and his ilk were conceiving back in the early 20th century, and how this breadbasket became what it is today?
Yeah, so basically, you know, you're in 1908, 1907, Mulholland, as well as other Angelenos, they are conceiving of this massive aqueduct. Specifically, it's called the Los Angeles Aqueduct. It's finally built and completed in November 1913. It took over like 2,000 people to build it, you know, over 160 tunnels. And basically, water from the Owens River reaches a reservoir in the San Fernando Valley, and that is, you know, that water is then, you know, used by Angelenos for their agriculture, for their drinking water, etc. And so after this aqueduct, you know, investors in the San Fernando Valley, basically speculators across the country, or people who are showing up to California are realizing, hey, we need so much more water to convert, you know, Los Angeles from this, you know, tiny oasis into this massive, like, you know, the Switzerland of California, basically. You know, basically pull so much water into Los Angeles that Los Angeles is able to be one of the most massive cities in the United States. And so eventually, you know, so much water is pulled from the Owens Valley that to this day there are people in the Owens Valley who are still trying to fight for their water. And then, you know, eventually Mulholland is like trying to get more water from the Colorado River itself, after, you know, most of the water from the Owens Valley is sort of taken. But that's how Los Angeles, or basically the San Fernando Valley, gets all of its water. It is basically pulling water from other regions like the Owens Valley. And this happens in, you know, in San Francisco, in Sacramento, in a lot of cities in the American West, right? It's the case in Colorado, in Utah. And so all of these different, you know, metropolises, they exist because they are able to pull water from other places. And they turn into these basically oases in this massive desert. And so, you know, the great historian like Mark Reisner, he wrote this great book called Cadillac Desert, right? And he, you know, he tells a story about Los Angeles and the Owens Valley. But the most important story that he sort of tells about the whole American West is that by the time you get to the late 20th century, California and other states have taken up so much water that the increasing possibility of basically being destroyed by a drought or the impact of climate change or whatever just gets higher and higher with every passing year. So, you know, California has been in basically a state of drought for almost a decade now. And even before that, it's been in, you know, there are massive periods of drought. But one thing that you see across the American West is that the periods of drought start growing and growing. It just becomes more and more common. This is true in not just California, but in Colorado, Utah, Nevada, etc. And so, you know, places like Las Vegas are going to be dealing with a massive water scarcity problem. But basically, the story you asked about the San Fernando Valley is a common story of a lot of cities in the American West, like Las Vegas, like San Francisco, Sacramento, et cetera. It's just how it works in the American West. Whoever gets to this water first, whoever is able to convince the federal government or the state government the fastest, and whoever's able to build these canals or these aqueducts or pump this groundwater the fastest or, you know, build these massive reservoirs, they're the ones who get the water. But the problem today, let's just take the Hoover Dam, for example, right? So the reservoir that's, you know, attached to Hoover Dam, it basically provides the water for such a massive population. I think it's over a couple million people. But today the reservoir is only at like 30% capacity. And so in a couple of decades, it's going to be basically impossible to justify pulling as much water as we do. And so at this point, a lot of Western legislators, even federal government legislators, have no idea what to do about the incoming years.
So you explained how there's a difference in water rights historically between the East and the Western parts of the United States, this riparian concept. Bring us up to today, where I assume that there's not as much conflict in a state which has a lot of agriculture, let's say New Jersey, over water rights versus California, where anybody who's driven between San Francisco and Los Angeles sees a lot of the signs from angry farmers saying this is Nancy Pelosi's problem and the like. It's a huge political hot button issue in the American West. Is it not like this in the East merely because of the riparian roots, or is there more to it?
I think the reason it's partially because of the precedent that is set in Eastern United States in the 19th century compared to the West, but it's also just because the climate is fundamentally different, and then the industries are fundamentally different, right? So obviously there is agriculture, there is certain industries in the Eastern United States that require a lot of water, but most of the agriculture, most of the massive industrial requirements for water are in the Western states. And so that's why the conflict is still so high today. For example, today, you know, because of this massive drought, you know, California is considering leasing water rights and basically trying to convince certain farmers and certain businesses and enterprises to lease their water, to buy water from the state. And so water is becoming more and more of a commodity. Like, it was already a commodity, you know, since the creation of the United States. It's always been a commodity in the U.S., but it's becoming more and more commodified, specifically in the American West, because of the climate how it's fundamentally different than the American East. And so that's why you see so much more conflict over water in the West than you do in the East. It's not, you know, it's not the case that there was never fights over dams and mills and dikes and canals in the American East, right? But it's always been a much bigger fight in the American West.
Swell from a northern blue sky. Smile on their faces, they entered their doom like they knew. If the world should end, they won't care about that anyway. I drink the water and I burn the fire. You play with chemicals, making their doom like you knew. If the world should end, you won't care about that anyway. Maybe that's the way you live your life, but I know life, it don't always live that way. Jade, a shade of pain, and then we die. Jade, a shade of pain, and then we die. Jade.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Varsha Venkata Subramanian. So, Varsha, you mentioned the leasing of water and how the state of California, for example, it wants farmers to lease water from the state. How is that different from the previous arrangement that these farmers may have had?
I messed up the what I was trying to say. It's not just that the farmers are going to be trying to lease water, but specifically that the state governments and all these city governments, they need more water. So they want to lease rights from the farmers. That's what I wanted to say.
I see. So with that in mind, will that relationship shift moving forward, and how will it impact smaller farmers? Because you could see the bigger farmers kind of swallowing up these water rights.
Yeah, so that's the main problem. So even if, you know, these cities try to responsibly buy water rights or buy water from different you know, people, you're never going to be able to provide this, create this equitable relationship between smaller farmers and larger, you know, larger farmers. And that's why in California, as well as in other states, the agricultural industry is mainly led by like a few massive companies. It's like massive agriculture. You're no longer seeing these small farms that are able to make a profit in the same way that they used to in the early 20th century or in the late 19th century.
And to be clear, there's really no delineation between these big agricultural outfits in terms of organic farming products and non-organic produce that you might be purchasing. Sorry to interrupt. Go on.
Yeah, right. That's the story of agriculture and water in the American West, is that because the federal government, or basically a lot of these states, right, especially let's just take California as an example. If, you know, your listeners have read Rivers of Empire by Don Worster or Cadillac Desert by Mark Reisner, they will know that the main relationships that are developed in the water story in California over the 20th century is a relationship between big businesses, especially agro-businesses, state governments and city governments, and the federal government. These massive water projects in California, in Nevada, whatever, all of these massive dams, they would not have been possible if not for this relationship, this type of investor, mutually reinforcing relationship you have between the federal government and these, you know, these industries in the American West. And that is why smaller and smaller farmers, smaller and smaller industries, smaller and smaller businesses, and even just like the daily lives of Native Americans and other citizens have been growing more and more difficult when it comes to access to water. Because the American West, since it has been this pulling point for white settlers in the mid-19th century, has been this pinnacle, or has been like this perfect symbol of the American dream for not just the federal government, but also for these state governments, also for these individuals. This idea that this is the place where you can finally not just own your own property, but you can build your own business and you can reach the heights of American society. And so it has been the best place to exercise and to practice American capitalism, the American West. But when you're practicing American capitalism, you are going to need more and more resources. And that is how you end up with a situation where there are only basically three major entities or three different institutions, you know, businesses, state governments, and federal governments that have access and have the ability to develop as much and take as much of the water as they need. And individual citizens as well as Native Americans are basically left behind.
So obviously, this is a fragile ecosystem in so many ways, and water is the key to all of it. What should people who care about the environment, what should they be looking for in the decades to come in these ongoing and probably escalating water wars, Varsha?
So as I sort of went over in this piece that I wrote, the three main reasons that there is going to be this massive conflict over water, not just in the American West, but maybe across the United States, is because of, one, we have been building dams, or the height of dam building in America has died down, but we have built thousands upon thousands of dams in the United States. But the thing is, all these dams are, as the young people call, boomers. They're basically old, they are failing, but if they are not repaired quickly, if they're not repaired in the next, you know, 10 or 15 years, you're going to see a lot more dam collapses in the United States, which is going to not only cause problems with like flooding and all these different things, but you're going to see the loss of a lot of different reservoirs, right? And so the access to water is challenged by that, by the fact that we have a basically massively ailing infrastructure of dams. The second reason we are coming up on, you know, massive, the potential of like a massive water war is not just climate change, but specifically in the American West, the aridity and, you know, the lack of access to water is just getting higher and higher. And that's mainly, you know, because of climate change issues, but also because of the way that water is allocated in the American West is deeply unfair, not just to, you know, certain Native American groups and, you know, certain people, but also between businesses, also between states. It's just massively unfair. And then the last thing that's important to sort of note is that it's not just that water rights are, you know, still contested in the American West between certain groups of people, but it's specifically that we have been pumping and taking out so much water from aquifers, you know, so much groundwater, that we are reaching up, you know, basically a point of no return where we won't have enough fresh water to keep the amazing city of Los Angeles green forever, or we won't be able to keep Las Vegas the oasis that it is. And so those are like the three main things that we're seeing. We're seeing massive overuse, a failing infrastructure, and the withering husk that is the oasis of the American West. It's because we are not combating these issues head on. So what people should really be looking for is what state governments and local governments, as well as the federal government, is doing to address issues of drought, water rights and water access, and finally, you know, failing infrastructure.
Varsha Venkata Subramanian, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Digga Rhythm Band, The Blind Boys of Alabama, and Seal. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.